Thank you for joining me. I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to this week's Torah portion from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown. This message is brought to you by themessianicmessage.com. themessianicmessage.com. I hope that you enjoy this teaching. This week's Torah portion is called Bo. It means enter, and it also means go. In fact, in this week's Torah portion, we're going to learn that they go so that they can enter. The Torah portion is Exodus chapter 10, starting at verse 1 to chapter 13, verse 16. The Haftarah is Jeremiah chapter 46, verses 13 through 28. The Brit Hadashah is Luke chapter 22, verses 7 to 30, and 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 20 to 34. And before we get started, let's ask the Lord to be with us. Baruch atah Yehovah Eloheinu Melech haolam. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe and creator of all things. You are Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, our family forefathers. And we just thank you that you are getting ready to bring us back to the land the same way that you did the first time, all those eons ago. And Abba, I just pray that you will prepare our hearts and minds and get us ready for this journey. I pray that you will deliver us, protect us, preserve us until we get there, and even after we get there, Abba, I just pray and thank you for your son, Yeshua, and for your Shabbats and all of your feasts and your word, Abba. May your kingdom come and your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. I just ask these things in the name of Yeshua. Amen. Okay, let's get right to it. Let's go to Exodus chapter 10, verse 1. Then the Lord told Moses, "Go to Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and the hearts of his officials in order to perform these signs of mine among them, so you may tell your children and your grandchildren how I toyed with the Egyptians and about my miraculous signs that I performed among them, so all of you may know that I am the Lord." Now, I want to bring your attention, I'm going to mention this a little bit later on, that the Lord was actually toying with the Egyptians. Now, it says here that the Lord has hardened Pharaoh's heart and the hearts of his officials. Let me ask, does the Lord have the right to harden a heart? Is he cruel to do this hardening of the heart thing? Well, let's take a look at something that has to do with the heart. Let's go to Jeremiah chapter 6, verse 30. Reprobate silver shall men call them, because the Lord has rejected them. So people that the Lord has rejected are called reprobate. And then Romans 1:28, "And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind to do those things which are not convenient." And then 2 Timothy 3:8, "Now as Jannes and Jambres withstood Moses, so do these also resist the truth. Men of corrupt minds, reprobate concerning the faith." And in Titus chapter 1 verse 16 it says, "They profess that they know God, but in works they deny him, being abominable and disobedient, and unto every good work reprobate." Let's take a look at that word reprobate, and I'll tie this in with how it affects what's going on between Pharaoh and the Lord. Reprobate in Hebrew is Strong's 3988. The word is ma'as. It means to spurn, to abhor, to cast away, to disdain. Now, this word ma'as is one letter different than the word ma'at, which means treachery. You know, idolatry is a ma'at, crime against Jehovah. Abhorring or casting away the Lord and his word causes you to be one letter away from treachery. And, of course, it means to spurn. So, reprobate, ma'as, means to spurn. They spurn the truth. Thus, they are spurned. You see how that works? If we spurn the truth, then we get spurned. Now, let's look at reprobate in Greek. It's autokimos, and it's Strong's 96, and it means the same thing as in Hebrew. It means rejected or worthless, cast away. You see? So, it's the same idea in Greek in that they reject the truth. Thus, they are rejected. tempted. And so this is the situation with Pharaoh and the Lord. Now in 2 Timothy 3:8, it says that Jannes and Jambres withstood Moses. And so who were Jannes and Jambres? They were two of Pharaoh's magicians that defied Moses. You remember when all of that stuff was going on, when Moses would, you know, turn the water to blood and his magicians would do the same thing, and then the frogs and so forth. It was these two guys that were involved in doing that. And now this is the first time in the Bible that we have them mentioned. Paul mentions them. We don't know their names from the Torah, but Paul knew who they were. You know, the Hebrews have always been great historians, and so whether or not somebody is mentioned in the Torah and then, you know, gets mentioned in the New Testament is not an issue, because we know that Paul was a scholar of all kinds, not only a Hebrew scholar and a Torah scholar, but also a historian as well. But you need to remember, going back to what it means to be reprobate, we need to remember that the Egyptians did know the Hebrews, and they knew who the Hebrew God was too. Now, I know Pharaoh said that he didn't know who this God of the Hebrews was, but, you know, I've already shown that I believe that he lied about this. And in fact, the lie is exposed in Exodus 9:27, when Pharaoh sent for Moses and said, I have sinned this time. The Lord is righteous, and I and my people are wicked. Yeah, he knew who Jehovah was. He had been lying about that. And in fact, what he said here is, I have committed a crime against the Lord. And then in Exodus 9:34, he says it again. He saw the rain, the hail, and the thunders that ceased, and he committed a crime further in his heart. So he hardened his heart, you see. So he is working on becoming reprobate. He is working on getting himself to a point where he will not humble himself before the Lord. And then in this week's Torah portion in Exodus 10:16, it says again that Pharaoh admits that he has committed a crime. He has sinned against the Lord and against you. He's talking to Moses and Aaron. And so he does know who Jehovah is. It is just that he and Jannes and Jambres chose to be reprobate. They chose to be worthless. And in turn, the Lord turns them over to that kind of mind. The Lord will turn a person over to this if that is the choice he makes. But there's more to it here too, because there is a legal matter to be considered. Pharaoh claims to be God. He claims to be the creator and owner of the earth. And of course, Jannes and Jambres, his magicians, are upholding Pharaoh's claim. Now, the way that Jehovah proves it is he and not Pharaoh who created and owns the earth and everything in it is by demonstrating his ability to destroy the Egyptians' gods. You know, they were able to demonstrate some power in the first three plagues, but after that, the Lord took over and said, here, fellas, let me show you how it's done. Thus, returning back to Exodus 10, verse 2, it says, the Lord toyed with them. You know, he let them win a few, just to, you know, give them a sense of accomplishment, or, you know, to egg them on to continue, whatever. But legally, the Lord has the right to do whatever he wants with Pharaoh and his men, and by the way, with everyone, because they were warned. You know, the reason that people object that God is cruel here, you know, that he's cruel to do this, is because they know that if they acknowledge his sovereignty over them, then they will also have to admit that this reprobate mind thing, this thing where the Lord turns them over to whatever mind they want to have, this, you know, could happen to them. And so they would rather denounce God as being cruel than to humble themselves before him. And of course, because Jehovah can do anything he wants with what he owns, he can use a person's own evil against him, and he has the biblically legal right to do so. How is that? Well, it is because in the ancient Near Eastern context, a conqueror is seen as a god. And of course, in the mind of a Gentile, he would be God because he conquered. It isn't that, you know, he's God and he is able to conquer. conquer. But either way, he gets to demonstrate that he is God. And in the Great Tribulation, we're going to have this same scenario again. Jehovah is going to conquer all of his foes to show us that only he is God of the earth. Exodus chapter 10, verse 3. Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and told him, "This is what the Lord God of the Hebrews says. How long will you refuse to humble yourself before me? Let my people go so they may serve me." You see, the Lord would always prefer that a person humble himself before him, but most people won't. They don't want to be humble before the Lord. And then in this verse, it's just another reiteration that we cannot serve the Lord in our full capacity outside the land. That's why Moses keeps repeating, "Let my people go so that they may serve me." They can't serve the Lord in the land of Egypt because, first of all, that land is claimed by Pharaoh. The Lord has to destroy Pharaoh. And the Lord has to take them to the land that he promised to Abraham. So even if the Lord took over Egypt and became Pharaoh in Egypt, he still wouldn't be fulfilling the promise given to Abraham, right? So we cannot serve the Lord in our fullness until we get into the land. We can do the best we can while we're in exile, though, right? Exodus 10:4. "But if you refuse to let my people go, tomorrow I'm going to bring locusts into your territory." Well, locusts are a punishment for disobedience. And as a matter of fact, locusts are a punishment in the curses in Deuteronomy 28. Deuteronomy 28:38 and verse 42 says, "You shall carry much seed into the field and shall gather but little in, for the locust shall consume it." See, when that's the chapter he says, choose blessings or choose curses. If you choose cursing, if you disobey, then you're going to get the locusts coming to your field to eat what you've sown. And in verse 42, it says, "In all your trees and fruit of your land shall the locust consume." So locusts are part of the curses. And we know that the punishments listed in Deuteronomy 28 and the plagues that fell in Egypt will have great tribulation parallels as well. And as a matter of fact, let's go to Revelation chapter 9 and read verses 3 and 7. "And there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and unto them was given powers, as the scorpions of the earth have power. And the shapes of the locusts were like unto horses prepared to battle, and on their heads it were, as it were, crowns like gold, and their faces were as the faces of men." So you see, we're going to have this locust thing on the during the Great Tribulation on the earth. In verse 5 of Exodus 10, it says, "They'll cover the surface of the land so a person cannot see the ground, and they'll eat what is left for you of the residue from the hail. They'll also eat all your trees that grow in the orchard." You know, that sounds a lot like, you know, the curses there in Deuteronomy 28. But regarding the Great Tribulation, when the locusts come this time, they're not coming to hurt the foliage. This time, they're coming to hurt the people. Revelation chapter 9, verse 10. It says, "And they had tails like unto scorpions, and there were stings in their tails, and their power was to hurt men 5 months." Not trees, and not foliage, and not crops in the fields. These things are coming after people this time. So here is a new thing that we see, because this locust thing is not even listed among the plagues of Revelation. It is listed as a woe, and the woes are a whole new category of curse. So this locust thing gets really ramped up at the end of days in the Great Tribulation. All right, verse 6. "Your houses will be filled along with the houses of all your officials and the houses of all the Egyptians, something that neither your fathers nor your ancestors ever saw from the time they were on earth until now." Then Moses turned and left Pharaoh's presence. And so we see here that we have a veiled reference to the deaths of the firstborn. And so Moses is trying to give an ominous warning to Pharaoh. And then after the warning was over, Moses just turned on his heels and left. Now, you know that warning played on Pharaoh's mind, right? That was what it was designed to do. It was designed to keep him up at night. Verse 7. "Then the officials of Pharaoh told him, 'How long will this man be a snare to us? Let the people go so they may serve the Lord their God. Don't you realize yet that Egypt is is about to be destroyed? Moses and Aaron were brought back to Pharaoh, and he told them, "Go, serve the Lord your God." But exactly who will go? Moses said, "We will go with our young and with our old. We will go with our sons and our daughters, with our sheep and our cattle, because it's a festival to the Lord for us." Then Pharaoh told them, "The Lord will certainly be with you if I let you and your little ones go. I know some evil plan is in your mind. No, let the men go and serve the Lord, for that is what you were seeking." Then they were driven out from the presence of Pharaoh. So he was trying to get the last word here, see? The Lord told Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the land of Egypt to bring the locusts, and they'll come up over the land of Egypt and eat all the vegetation of the land and everything that the hail left." Moses stretched out his staff over the land of Egypt, and the Lord sent an east wind into the land all that day and throughout the night. When morning came, the east wind brought the locusts. So, let's take a look at these curses, because it appears that curses are brought by the east wind. Now, in the end of days, what comes from the east? Islam. And this is a curse, as I have said. So, what is one of the words for curse in Hebrew? Well, there is a word for curse in Hebrew, and it is Allah, and it is Strong's 423, and it means curse, cursing, execration, oath, and swearing. Now, what does curse, cursing, execration, oath, and swearing have to do with each other? Well, the root of Allah is Strong's 422, which is to imprecate or adjure, or that means to bring a lawsuit, to curse, and to swear. See, this word Allah has something to do with swearing oaths and getting curses. Now, Islam requires an oath to be sworn, and for the person who takes that oath to suffer a curse if he fails to uphold the oath that he swore. So if you take the oath to Islam, then you will suffer a curse from Jehovah. So either way, you see, swearing an oath to Islam is going to bring you a curse, because you're going to be cursed by Islam, and you're going to be cursed by the Lord. Why do I say you're going to be cursed by Islam? Well, because Muslims kill their own people. We just had recently in Syria an example of this, where men lined up other men who are, they're all Muslims, but some of them belong to different sects and so forth. Some of them lined up these other men and said, "Can you repeat these particular lines?" Well, the other men couldn't repeat those lines. They couldn't say that particular prayer, and so they were executed, see, for not being able to say the particular prayer. So these people curse each other. You see how you get cursed by Islam and by Jehovah if you take the mark of the beast and swear an oath to Allah. Exodus 10:14. "And the locusts came up over all the land of Egypt and settled on all the territory of Egypt in great swarms." There had never been locusts like this before, nor would there ever be again. Now, I've been reading out of the International Standard Version, because there are cases when it's probably easier to understand, whereas the King James Version has other things that, like, for instance, keywords that don't often show up in the other versions. But I wanted to read this Torah portion in the International Standard Version this week, because it's much simpler to understand what's going on. But I want to take you to the King James Version of Exodus 10:14, and there's a reason I'm doing this. It says in the King James Version, "And the locusts went up over all the land of Egypt and rested in all the coasts of Egypt. Very grievous were they. Before them there were no such locusts as they, neither after them will be such." Well, the International Standard Version uses the word territory, and the King James Version uses the word coasts. But this is very important for us right now, because the Lord is teaching the Egyptians and us that Egypt is only a territory. It's a piece of land situated on the earth. How do I know that? Because that's what the Hebrew word means. It's Strong's 1366. The word is pronounced Gabul, and it means a boundary, and by extension, a territory, a border, a coast, and so forth. So the Lord is now referring to Egypt, not just as the land of Egypt, but as just a place where, you know, it's on the earth and there's some borders around it. It's not really all that important to the Lord, you know. He's not going to uphold Egypt. He's going to uphold Israel, because those are his borders. orders, the ones that he gave to Israel. And because he's reiterating that this is only a territory with borders, what he's implying is that he is the one that owns the whole earth. And so even during the Great Tribulation, there will be countries with borders. One of the things that the beast system, whether all the way back from Babylon and Egypt going forward, what that beast system has never been able to do is get the earth under his control without there being some borders, some territories that are separate from others. He's trying to get a borderless earth by doing what Pharaoh did, making claim to the whole earth because he was Pharaoh of Egypt. But the only time that there's going to be a borderless earth is going to be during the kingdom. When the kingdom is reigning on the earth, there will be no countries. Now, there will be during the millennial kingdom because we learn about, you know, people coming from other countries and those who don't come up from Egypt and so forth and so on. There's coming a time when the earth will not be divided up into territories. Verse 15, they covered the surface of the entire land so that it was dark. They ate all the vegetation of the land and the fruit of the trees that the hail left. Nothing green was left on the trees or on the vegetation in all the land of Egypt. Pharaoh quickly called Moses and Aaron and said, I've sinned or committed a crime against the Lord your God and against you. So here is, again, a repeat where he says he is admitting that he has committed a crime against a God that he said he didn't know. Exodus 10:17. Now, please forgive my sin only this time, and pray to the Lord your God that he would at least remove this from me. See, he only wants forgiveness for this one transgression. He doesn't want to humble himself and accept forgiveness for all of his sins. But the Lord just goes ahead and gives him what he wants. Moses left Pharaoh and went and prayed to the Lord, and so then the Lord brought up a strong west wind that drove the locusts into the Red Sea. But in verse 20 it says the Lord made Pharaoh's heart stubborn and he would not let the Israelites go. And so the Lord told Moses, stretch your hand toward the sky and there will be darkness over the land of Egypt, a darkness that one can feel. So Moses stretched his hand toward the sky and there was thick darkness in all the land of Egypt for 3 days. No one could see anyone else, nor could anyone get up from his place for 3 days, but there was light for all the Israelites in their dwellings. See, this is going to be part of our situation in the Great Tribulation, where the rest of the earth, those who are outside of the assemblies, wherever those assemblies are, those who are outside the assemblies are going to suffer from darkness. But why would we not suffer from that darkness? Well, it's because we're going to have a pillar of fire with us. Fire creates light, and so we will have light with us. So Pharaoh then, he tries to make another deal. He says, go serve the Lord, but leave your flocks and cattle behind. Just take your little ones, but leave everything else behind. And Moses says, we got to have our animals in order to do the sacrifices and burnt offerings. And he says, you know, we're going to take our our cattle with us. Not a hoof will be left behind, he said. So here we see that Pharaoh has the wrong idea. He thinks that he can make a bargain with Jehovah through Moses. He thinks that he can talk Moses into doing something different than what the Lord wants him to do. By the way, this is likely to happen in the Great Tribulation too. You know, those 144,000 guys who are our Moses guys in each of our camps, there's going to be people trying to talk them into doing stuff that the Lord said, you know, let's not do that. And so Pharaoh thinks that he can talk Moses into making a lesser deal because he doesn't want to face the prospect of having all the Hebrews leave Egypt permanently. But the Lord made his heart stubborn again, and Pharaoh said, get away from me and watch out that you never see my face again, because on the day that you see my face, you will die. Moses said, just as you have said, I won't see your face again. You see, he's prophesying over Pharaoh. Moses never again sees the face of Pharaoh. Chapter 11, verse 1. The Lord told Moses, I'll bring one more plague on Pharaoh and Egypt. After that, he'll let you leave from here. And when he lets you go, he will certainly drive you out from here. So he's not only going to let them leave, but he's going to want to get rid of them so bad he's going to drive them out. The Lord said, tell the people that each man is to ask his neighbor and each woman her neighbor for articles of silver and gold. Why is that? Well, it's because, remember, they have not been paid their wages. They're getting their wages on the way out. The Lord made the Egyptians look on the people with favor, and even the Pharaoh's officials looked on the people with favor. And so Moses announced to Pharaoh, this is what the Lord says. About midnight, I'm going throughout Egypt. Now let's examine that little phrase there. Midnight is called the witching hour. That is the time when Satan's demon deities, you know, all those pagan Gentile gods, that's the time when they claim a day begins. It's like, you know, the middle of, it's not even the middle of the night. I guess it's the middle of the night, but it's not the middle of a 24-hour day. It's only like one quarter of a day off. But you see, that's what Satan does. He takes what the Lord has and he makes it just a little bit different. Just twists it just a little bit and people, you know, eat that stuff up. Verse 5, and all the firstborn in the land of Egypt will die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on his throne to the firstborn of the slave girl who operates the handmill, along with the firstborn of the animals. Why is he pronouncing death to the firstborns? Well, it's because, again, we have a legal situation here. All of the firstborns belong to Jehovah. They have belonged to Jehovah from the beginning. Yet here they are in Egypt, and Satan has conscripted them for service in the pagan Egyptian temples. In the ancient Near East, in ancient Egypt, all firstborns in the land of Egypt had to go for service in the temples. And so the Lord has a legal reason now for taking the firstborns. First of all, it's the firstborns that do the rituals in the temples. Okay? So not only do the firstborns belong to Jehovah anyway, but they're all supposed to be in the temples doing rituals. Well, one of the ways you kill a god is you take away their priesthood. So you kill the god to get rid of the priests. And so that's another reason why the Lord is going to kill all those firstborns, because no firstborns, no temple rituals. Verse 6, there will be a great outcry throughout the land of Egypt like there has never been and never will be again. But among the Israelites, from people to animals, not even a dog will bark. So you may know that the Lord is distinguishing between the Egyptians and the Israelites. All of these officials of yours will come down to me, prostrate themselves to me, and say, get out, you and all the people following you. After that, I'll go out. Then Moses angrily left Pharaoh. The Lord told Moses, Pharaoh won't listen to you. As a result, my wonders will increase throughout the land of Egypt. Then Moses and Aaron did all these wonders in front of Pharaoh, but the Lord made Pharaoh's heart stubborn, and he would not let the Israelites go out from his land. Now, I earlier said that Moses would not see Pharaoh again. So how did he get this message to Pharaoh? I believe that he probably sent it, because it says Moses announced to Pharaoh. It wasn't like he was standing in front of Pharaoh. He announced to Pharaoh some other way. There's a whole other wording there, and I believe that it was through a messenger. Exodus 12:1. The Lord told Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, this month will mark the beginning of months for you. It will be the first month of the year for you. The Lord sets up his fiscal calendar here. See? Now, in the next section, we're going to get Passover instructions. Starting at verse 3, chapter 12, verse 3. Here's what he says. Tell the entire congregation of Israel, on the 10th of this month, they're to take each to take a lamb for themselves, according to their ancestors' households, one lamb for each household. If a household is too small for a lamb, then it and its closest neighbor are to obtain one based on the number of individuals, dividing the lamb based on what each person can eat. Your lamb is to be a year-old male without blemish. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. It is to remain under your care until the 14th day of this month, and then the entire assembly of the congregation of Israel is to slaughter it at twilight. They're to take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses where they eat the lamb. This putting the blood on the doorposts has to do with smearing out and covering over and getting rid of the names of the gods that the Israelites had engraved on their doorposts, because that's how pagans worship in their homes. They put, you know, the names of the gods and decorations from the gods and all of that on their doorposts. hosts. And it says in verse 8, that very night they're to eat the meat roasted over fire with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. Don't eat any of it raw or boiled in water. Instead, roast it over the fire with its head, legs, and internal organs. Don't leave any of it until morning, and whatever does remain of it until morning, you are to burn in the fire. You know, there's a whole lot going on here that has to do with the Messiah. For instance, having to have him among them and live among them, and them having to kill him and leave him whole. You know, I don't have time to go into all of that. Also, I've done a teaching called Passover, Its Meaning Then and Now, which goes into the reason why we do not put blood on the doorposts now. That was a one-time event, and I explain all that in that teaching. It's about an hour and a half long. And it says, this is how you are to eat it, with your cloak tucked into your belt, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. You're to eat it hurriedly. It's the Lord's Passover. I'll pass through the land of Egypt that night and strike every firstborn in the land of Egypt, both animals and people. I'll execute judgments on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are. I'll see the blood and pass over you. There will be no plague to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. You see, the blood on the doorposts wiping out the names and decorations of those other gods is a symbol to the Lord that they are turning their backs on those other gods and that they are coming into covenant with him. Now, these, as I said, were the Passover instructions. Now we're going to get the memorial instructions for Passover. Verse 14, this day is to be a memorial for you, and you are to celebrate it as a festival to the Lord. You are to celebrate it as a perpetual ordinance from generation to generation. In other words, this is an ordinance, and with ordinances are within the law. The law will be given at Mount Sinai, and there will be more specifics coming along to tell us how to keep the ordinance. You're to eat unleavened bread for 7 days. On the first day, be sure to remove all the leaven from your houses, because any person who eats anything leavened from the first day till the seventh will be cut off from Israel. Also, on the first day, you're to hold a holy assembly, and on the seventh day, you're to hold a holy assembly. No work is to be done during those days except for preparing what is to be eaten by each person. You are to observe the festival of unleavened bread, since on this very day I brought your tribal divisions from the land of Egypt. You are to observe this day from generation to generation as a perpetual ordinance. In the first month, from the evening of the 14th day of the month until the evening of the 21st day of the month, you are to eat unleavened bread. For 7 days, leaven is not to be found in your houses. Indeed, any person who eats anything leavened is to be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether an alien or a native of the land. You are not to eat what is leavened. You are to eat unleavened bread in all your settlements. What is the first thing that you can notice that is missing from the memorial instructions that was given for in the beginning of the chapter for the people when back there in Egypt? What is the one common element what's missing here in the instructions for the memorial? It's the blood. Nothing is said about blood. Nothing is said about taking a lamb and killing it and putting its blood on the doorpost. It just talks about the unleavened bread here, you see. So this is the big difference between the first Passover and the way we memorialize it then. It has to do with the blood. Now in the next few verses, Moses explains Passover to the elders. Then Moses summoned the elders of Israel and told them, choose sheep for your family and slaughter the Passover lamb. So he's gone back now. He's gotten away from the memorial instructions. Now he's back with the elders and he's telling them, okay, we're gonna take the lamb, we're gonna slaughter the lamb, and we're gonna take a bundle of hyssop and dip it in the blood, and we're gonna do this thing to the lintel and the two doorposts, and don't go out of the doorway of your house until morning, because the Lord is going to pass through to strike down the Egyptians. And when he sees the blood on the lintel and the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the doorway and won't allow the destroyer to enter your houses to strike you down. So then in the next few verses, Moses explains the memorial to the elders. Okay, so first we have the Passover instructions, then we have the memorial instructions. Then we have Moses explaining the Passover instructions to the elders, and then we have him explaining the memorial to the elders. See, the Lord was explaining to Passover to Moses and Aaron at the beginning of the chapter, right? And then he explained the memorial to Moses and Aaron, right? Now it's up to Moses to explain this to the elders. So that's why we have this back and forth in chapter 12 that causes confusion in groups and causes people to go astray and put blood on their doorposts, which in the Torah it says that is idolatry now. After that one time you do it again, it's idolatry now, you see? But you can get all that information in Passover, its meaning then and now. But now we're down to Exodus 12:24, where Moses is explaining the memorial to the elders. He says, you are to observe this event as a perpetual ordinance for you and your children forever. There's that word ordinance. So there's going to be some additional instruction that comes. When you enter the land that the Lord will give you, just as he promised, you are to observe this ritual, this ordinance ritual. And when the children say to you, what does this ritual mean? You are to say, it is the Passover sacrifice to the Lord, who passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt when he struck down the Egyptians, but spared our houses. Then the people bowed down and worshipped. So the Lord is going to give more specific instructions when he gives us the Torah at Mount Sinai. Now notice that there were no specific instructions given really to the elders here. It was just a kind of a broad general outline, right? The specific instructions on how the memorial is to be kept is yet to come. Moses did not pass along the details of the memorial instruction. In fact, those details that the Lord gave to Moses and Aaron earlier about eating the unleavened bread, he didn't even pass those details on. He just said, you know, we're going to do this memorial and we're going to tell our children, you know, that, you know, this is what the Lord did. Okay, so moving on, verse 28. The Israelites did this. Moses and Aaron did just what the Lord had commanded. So at midnight, the Lord struck down every firstborn in the land. And we know the story. You know, Pharaoh got up during the night. He was probably hearing all the wailing going on in Egypt. Every house had someone dead in it. And then, so he did, you know, he fulfilled the prophecy that Moses told him, you know, that Pharaoh would drive them out. So Pharaoh just says, take both your sheep and your cattle and everything. You, all of you, go and get out. So Pharaoh finally accepts defeat. Verse 33. The Egyptian officials urged the people to send them out of the land quickly because they were saying, we'll all be dead. So the people took their dough before it was leavened with their kneading bowls wrapped up in their cloaks on their shoulders. You see, this is the reason behind the unleavened bread instructions. Meanwhile, the Israelites had done as Moses said. They had asked the Egyptians for objects of silver and objects of gold and for clothes. The Lord had given the people favor in the eyes of the Egyptians so that they gave them what they requested, and they plundered the Egyptians. About 600,000 men traveled from Ramses to Sukkot on foot, not counting the children. A mixed multitude went with them, along with a very large number of livestock, including sheep and cattle. They baked the dough that they brought out of Egypt into thin cakes of unleavened bread. That's what they had to eat. While they were sitting there waiting for Pharaoh to come, they ate that unleavened bread. So, I want to go down to verse 40, and let's look at this, because it says here that the time the Israelites lived in Egypt was 430 years. It says they came out of Egypt 430 years to the very day. Now, listen, how did they know that this was 430 years to the very day? Well, because exactly 430 years earlier, what happened was the covenant of the pieces in Genesis 15, when the Lord gave the prophecy that they would be in the land, or in Egypt rather, for four generations. Now, yeah, that's good enough to say that, but how would they have known that it was 430 years to the day? Well, you know, they've never done Passover before. Yet they appear to have done a festival before. And in fact, I believe they were doing a commemorative festival of the Covenant of the Pieces on this very day for 430 years. It's the only way that they could have known when to, you know, that this was actually 430 years to the day, you see. And earlier, Moses said to the Pharaoh that they were going to the desert to do a festival to the Lord, right? Well, that was before he had gotten the Passover instructions. Apparently, Moses didn't even know what was coming because they had never done Passover before. But he knew they were going to do a festival to the Lord. You see, if you connect the dots, and you just do some reasoning, then you reach the conclusion that they had been commemorating this for 430 years. It's the only way they would have ever known that they left Egypt 430 years to the day. Verse 42. That was for the Lord a night of vigil to bring them out of the land of Egypt. This same night belongs to the Lord, and it is to be a vigil for all the Israelites from generation to generation. This is the thing that people don't understand. This Passover night is not just any night. It is a vigil to the Lord, and it belongs to the Lord the same way that the Sabbath belongs to the Lord. But the Sabbath was created for us. Passover was created for us, but they belong to the Lord. And then in verse 43, we have more instruction on the Passover memorial ritual. The Lord told Moses and Aaron, these are the regulations for the Passover. See, earlier I said ordinances have regulations. There's more to come. Now we're going to get more of the regulations in this same chapter. First of all, no foreigner is to eat it, though any slave purchased with money may eat it after you have circumcised him. Let's look at that word foreigner. It's nekar. It is Strong's 5236, and it means someone who lives in the land but doesn't want to integrate into the culture. You know, like what we have going on in the United States now. People come here, they want to remain whatever culture they are, and they don't want to learn English, they don't want to abide by our laws. They want to have their own laws. The Muslims, you know, they come here, they want their own laws, you know. They don't want to become Americans. Well, that's called a foreigner. You know, they don't want to join the covenant. Exodus 12:45 says, but no temporary resident or a hired servant is to eat it. Now, you see, the temporary servant word there. The word is Strong's 8453, and it is toshab. Toshab actually means a dweller. You know, it's somebody who is there temporarily. They know they're passing through. Okay? And then you have the hired servant. Hired servant is Strong's 7916, and it's sakir. And it just means basically somebody you pay wages to. Now, a hired servant cannot eat the Passover, but a slave, that because the slave belongs to you, you see, and if you circumcised him, he can eat the Passover, but the hired servant, no, because he doesn't belong to you. He's trading service for income, you see. The slave is a different deal. Verse 46, it is to be eaten in one house, and you are not to take any of the meat outside the house, nor are you to break any of its bones. The whole congregation of Israel is to observe it. If an alien who resides with you wants to observe the Passover to the Lord, every male in his household must be circumcised. Then he may come near to observe it. He is to be like a native of the land, but no uncircumcised person is to eat it. Who is this alien? Well, that is Strong's 1616. The word is ger, and it means a guest, but by implication, it's a person who has come who is intending to become part of the culture, okay? And that word ger, 1616, comes from the root word ger, which is Strong's 1481. It means to properly to turn aside from the road. That is, you know, they're coming to abide, to assemble, to dwell, to gather. You know, they're there. They're not part of the culture yet, but they're more than a foreigner. They're not just passing through, you see. Verse 49, a single law exists for the native and the alien who resides among you. All the Israelites did this. They did exactly as the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron. On that very day, the Lord brought the Israelites out of the land of Egypt by their tribal divisions. Visions, chapter 13, verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses, "Consecrate to me every firstborn male, whatever is the first to open the womb among the Israelites, both of humans and of animals, belongs to me." See, as I said before, the firstborns have always belonged to Jehovah from the beginning, from Adam forward. And here's the miracle. We are firstborns. You see, when we join the covenant, we join it as an individual. So we join as me to the Lord. So let's take a look at why I say that. Well, Yeshua is called the first fruits, right? He's the first fruits of what? Well, let's first, before I answer that question, let's go to where it talks about him being the first fruit. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and look at verses 20 and 23. But now is Messiah risen from the dead and become the first fruits of them that slept. But every man in his own order, Messiah, the first fruits, afterward, they that are Christ's or Messiah's at his coming. Okay, so he was the first fruits of all of the people that were in covenant with the Lord before they died, and he is the first fruit of those who are in covenant with the Lord when he returns at his second coming, right? So what is he the first fruit of? He is the first fruit of the firstborns. Let's go to Romans chapter 8, verse 29. For whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. Who is the, Colossians 1, verses 15 and 18. Who is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of every creature? And then jumping down to verse 18. And he is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn, born from the dead, that in all things he might have the preeminence. So he is firstborn and he is first fruits. Now listen, firstborn and first fruits are very connected. Yeshua is the first of other individuals who will follow his path. The next feast after Passover that comes during the week of unleavened bread is called Bikurim, or first fruits. Yeshua then is the firstborn, then the only firstborn that fulfilled Bikurim, or the Feast of First Fruits. Now listen, in the first Exodus, the entire community involuntarily was delivered. I mean, they literally were forced out of the land, were they not? Now, some other folks volunteered to come along, right? The mixed multitude came with them. They came out on their own, but the whole community thing overall was an involuntary deliverance. They didn't have a choice. The Lord was going to deliver them and take them to the land whether they wanted to go or not, you see? But this second Exodus that's coming is not involuntary. He's going to deliver a community of individuals who have volunteered for this, who have chosen to be in covenant with him. You see, the status for us is different the second time because Yeshua is the first fruits of the firstborn. I hope that makes sense. Now, in Exodus 13, starting at verse 3, Moses is going to give the Passover memorial instructions to the people. Part of the confusion, as I've said before, over how to do Passover is because we get this going back and forth thing. You know, the scripture says, do this, and then it says, do this, and we're not paying attention to who the Lord is talking. First, he talked to Moses and Aaron. Do this Passover this way. Do the memorial this way. Then Moses and Aaron, they go to the elders and they say, do Passover this way. Do the memorial this way. And now we're going to have Moses giving the memorial instructions to the people, okay? And notice that there's not any blood putting on doorposts or anything like that ever given in these memorial instructions. Not in the memorial instructions from the Lord to Moses, not in the memorial instructions from Moses to the elders, and not in the memorial instructions from Moses Moses to the people. Let's read starting at verse 3. When Moses told the people, "Remember this day on which you came out of Egypt from the house of bondage, because the Lord brought you out from this place with a strong show of force. Moreover, nothing leavened is to be eaten. Today, in the month of Abib, you are going out. When the Lord brings you to the land of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite, which he swore to your ancestors to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, you are to observe this ritual in this month. You are to eat unleavened bread for 7 days, and on the seventh day there is to be a festival to the Lord. Unleavened bread is to be eaten for 7 days, and nothing leavened is to be seen among you, nor is leaven to be seen among you throughout your territory. And you are to tell your children on that day, 'This is because of what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt.'" By the way, stopping right here, this is why Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 says that we're to view ourselves as we're the children of the people that came out of Egypt. It's our fathers, our personal fathers that came out of Egypt. Because what is our instruction? We're to say, "This is what the Lord did for me." Well, listen, I haven't been, redeemed or delivered or anything from Egypt. I'm out here in the diaspora, you see. But I am to tell my children, "This is what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt," you see. This is where Paul gets that instruction that he gives in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Exodus 13 verse 9. "It is to be a sign for you on your hand and a reminder on your forehead, so that you may speak about the instruction of the Lord. For the Lord brought you out of Egypt with a strong show of force." So Passover is one of the marks that the Lord puts on us. It's one of the marks that we take willingly. Passover is a mark like Shabbat is a mark, you see. Verse 10. "You are to keep this ordinance at its appointed time from year to year when the Lord brings you to the land of the Canaanite and gives it to you just as he promised you and your ancestors. You are to dedicate to the Lord everything that first opens the womb. All the firstborn males of your livestock belong to the Lord. You are to redeem every firstborn donkey with a lamb, and if you don't redeem it, you're to break its neck. You're to redeem every firstborn among your sons." By the way, this firstborn donkey that's redeemed by a lamb, that's an illustration or a symbolic gesture, a symbolic thing of, you know, we're like donkeys, we're stubborn like donkeys, and we're redeemed by a lamb. Verse 14. "Then when your child asks you in the future, 'What is this?' you are to say to him, 'The Lord brought us out of Egypt from the house of bondage with a strong show of force. And when Pharaoh stubbornly refused to let us go, the Lord killed every firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of humans to the firstborn of animals. Therefore, I sacrifice to the Lord every male that first opens the womb, but I redeem every firstborn of my sons." So every firstborn belongs to the Lord, and we have to redeem our firstborns so that they don't get conscripted involuntarily into the service of the Lord. Does that make sense? They have to be redeemed so that they can make that choice for themselves later on. That's because, unlike Satan and his demon deities who force people to serve them, the Lord will never force someone to serve him. He wants them to make that choice. So that's why we get to redeem our sons, our firstborn sons, back into our own households. "It is to be a sign on your hand and an emblem on your forehead, because the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a strong show of force." Passover, unleavened bread, and first fruits are the feasts that help us to remember that it is Yehovah who is the Lord of the earth. I hope this Torah portion has been a blessing to you. Shabbat Shalom.